Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Diana Graber, author of the book Raising Humans in a Digital World. Many of us have a love-hate relationship with technology, and this is especially true for parents as they try to maneuver their way through a field that seems to change every day. Diana and I had a very helpful conversation about what all of us can do to use the tool of technology wisely, both as parents and as consumers. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Diana Graber, thank you so much for joining me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So for those who aren't familiar with the work that you do or your book, I was wondering if you could just share a little bit of your background and how your book got inspired, and then also talk a little bit about the cyber civics class that you created. And I assume, are you still teaching it?
Yeah, I'm still. In fact, this afternoon, I've got two classes.
Okay.
Looking forward to.
Great.
Yeah. So, you know, like many journeys start, it was all about my kids.
Yeah.
So my previous life, I was a film and video producer. And as my children approached middle school, you know, I saw the digital world really changing. So I went back to school and got a master's in something called media psychology and social change, really with the intent to augment my video and film career. And really what happened is I fell down the digital literacy rabbit hole. And I really discovered, you know, how fast our world is changing, how unprepared we are as parents to equip our children with the skills they need to really be safe and productive and do all the wonderful things well that technology offers. So that's when I shifted my interest into kids and teaching them about digital literacy.
Was there much work being done as you were kind of going down those rabbit holes? Were you discovering that, I mean, I'm sure there was at least a little bit of work being done, but were you surprised, or was that one of the reasons why you decided to, I think I really want to go down this path and learn more?
You know, I think there was work being done, but in my view, it wasn't the right work. And one of the things that really pushed me over the edge is seeing, you know, a lot of online safety experts giving talks at schools to both parents and children. And it was mostly about, don't do this, don't do that. These are the horrible things happening out there. And it was really people with not a lot of, you know, breadth of knowledge or research to back them up. Hmm. And sure, there's some bad things happening, but, you know, what the data shows us is that's really just a small percentage. And with education, we can make it even smaller. And so I felt like children and parents weren't getting the right message. So that's was really my impetus to go out there and try to offer a different perspective.
Yeah. Can you walk us through what is a cyber civics class? What typically, how you meet with, is it just the students that you meet with? And then how long do you meet with them? And what are some of the things that you talk about?
Yeah, well, the way cyber civics really came about is when I got into this business, we started with CyberWise, which is a digital literacy site for parents. And I realized parents are busy and, you know, they're not going to really have time to educate themselves on all the things there are to know. So that's when I started working with students, and I got the opportunity at my own child's school to teach a weekly class throughout the entirety of their middle school years, so 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And we address all the topics that encompass digital literacy, which include digital citizenship, information literacy, and media literacy. And so basically what we do is we take 50 minutes a week, that's 50 minutes a week, and we just, you know, do activities that introduce them to these different topics. So to give you an example, I missed the first couple weeks of my own students' classes because I've been traveling. So this is week 3. So I'm going to go in this afternoon. And I know that last week, these students, my 7th graders, tracked how much media they use in the course of a 24-hour day. Mm. So when I go in today, they're going to have little graph charts that they've made to show their individual media use. And then what I'll have them do is gather in groups of 4 and add up to see how much time 4 of them spent on a typical day using digital media. And really the purpose of that lesson is to give them a visual reference of how much time screen time takes of our day that we don't even realize. And what I've found is doing activities like this with kids, it's kind of eye-opening for them. And it's not like I'm lecturing them about their screen time. They're discovering how screens are so invasive in our lives and sometimes get in the way of other activities.
Yeah, that it's a helpful insight. And then also what I found helpful was about the book was it seems like both with youth perhaps and with adults is that we have this kind of love-hate relationship with our technology. On the one hand, we cannot imagine living our lives without it. But on the other hand, I think my guess is most people know they probably shouldn't be spending as much time on it as they should. And so they think, I need to just get rid of it. But then something just compels it us to go back on our devices. It seems like in the book anyway, that you offer a different way where you're talking about really good can come out of these new devices, but that we need to be careful with how we use them. And was that, when you went into your research and your studies, was that your sense going into it, or did the studies that you did change how you saw it?
You know, the studies really changed. And I really have to credit one spectacular professor I have, Dr. Pamela Rutledge, who's all over the place talking about these topics. And she's so bright. But, you know, she had this mantra is like, they're just tools, you know? Mm. And so if we always come back to that, it's like, these are tools that should make our lives better. You know what I mean? We should use them. They shouldn't use us.
Yeah.
It's a pretty simple mantra to remember. And it's especially simple one to teach students, young students. And, you know, we have to remember there's some great things that we can do with our phones. I mean, we can use them for finding our way to get somewhere. They're a calculator. We can keep notes with them. But sometimes we forget that and we let them, you know, capture our attention in ways that aren't really so useful. So really that's what I'm trying to impart to students via a bunch of activities and letting them come to that discovery on their own.
Does that usually happen? Do they come to that discovery? And in the years that you've done cyber civics, I can't remember how many years ago that you started it, have any of them come back to you now that they're maybe 17, 18, 19 and still tell you, boy, that class was really helpful as I grow older and still use my device?
You know, I wasn't sure because you wonder what will happen as they get into high school and college and beyond. And so when I was working on my book, I had my intern actually go back and interview my very first crop of students who are now all in college.
Okay.
And surprisingly, they all remembered the class and they had really embedded practices that they had learned through the class and have maintained throughout their, you know, now young adulthood. And so that was pretty exciting. And one of the two things that they really remembered was to use it as a tool, which I was really excited about. And the second thing was to really manage their digital reputations. Mm. And so all the kids that she interviewed none of them had fallen into the trap of posting something inappropriate online because they knew the consequences were so huge, so that they had avoided that unfortunate pitfall.
Yeah. Is digital reputation, is that one of the things I think I was mentioning to you before we started recording, is my children are now teenagers. And I think a lot of parents are probably, they know they need to do something and they're just kind of wandering around. I have no idea how to respond to this onslaught of devices and everything else. When you talk to parents, what are their top concerns? Is it digital reputation? Is that, I would imagine that's probably one of the things, but what are the others?
You know, surprisingly, it's not what comes up right away.
Oh, really?
You know, funny, because I just returned from a little community in Minneapolis. And I always usually start my presentations with a simple question. I say, when I say kids and technology, what's the first word that pops in your head? And it was hilarious because before I even got the sentence out, it was like a couple parents said, addiction. Like that's the first thing in every community, large, small, whatever type of pedagogy they use in their classroom. That's the number one concern is that they say addiction. And it's funny because it's not technically an addiction. It's not classified as an addiction, but using technology too much is the number one thing parents worry about. And very rarely does anyone say anything about reputation. Although in my view, that is probably more concerning than time spent online because it has such a long lasting impact on a child's future.
And when parents say addiction, as you note, probably technically that's not correct, but when they say that, what do they mean by the addiction? Is it just, I'm worried that my kid is just spending so much time with their device and they I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't know how to manage it. And, you know, a lot of it's out of their control because kids are spending a lot of time on screens in school or for school.
Right.
And so that's challenging for parents because kids come home and say, I got to do my homework on the computer. And it's like, you know, homework interspersed with YouTube videos and text messages from your friends and everything else. So it's really hard. Hmm.
Do those parents, when they come to you, I think we live in the days with all the articles, of course, with top five ways to do X, Y, or Z to improve your life. And so when parents come to you with concerns, do they want you usually to say, Diana, just give me the top three things that I need to do. Give me the specific, like how many hours a day I should be limiting my child to. And then I don't know if you answer with those, but my hunch is that you probably try to give them a little broader answer than that. But is that typically like, just tell me what to do. And then how do you respond to those?
Parents do want the quick fix.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I hate to say this, but my response to them is there is not a quick fix. I mean, parenting is a hard job, as you know, and it's probably 10 times harder today with digital devices all around. So, in my talks that I give to parents, it's the same thing as I say in my book. It's like building a house. Mm-hmm. You can't build a house overnight. You've got to lay a strong foundation of great social emotional skills, give them pillars of knowledge, and then put them out in a community and teach them how to interact with other people safely. And so, I don't want to leave parents feeling despair because, oh my gosh, that's so much work. And so I do finish with like my three top tips, which are number one, let kids be kids, delay giving them digital devices as long as you can. Number two, if you do give a young child a device, use parental controls. And number three, the most important tip is educate. The most powerful filter in the world is the one kids carry around between their ears. So it's really incumbent upon us to teach them how to use it well.
And for that third point, what would you say? I guess I'm looking for a couple, three subpoints underneath that. So for example, you give at the end of every book, at the end of every chapter in your book, you offer some really great tips on, here are some things that you like, practical examples of what parents can do. So for example, my son, he now has a laptop. And so we went through the exercise. We're going through this kind of week by week. And so we started with one of the first exercises of Google yourself and family to kind of see what you learn. Right. And so of those exercises that you offer in the book, are there two or three that you really highlight to parents?
Well, I like the Google yourself one because it's a pretty powerful way to show kids how you're judging somebody else by their digital reputation without you lecturing about that. So that's a good one. The other one I really love, and I really have to credit one of my students for it. I had a student a few years ago, and she told me that whenever she wanted to use a new app like Instagram or Snapchat, she had to research it first and create a PowerPoint presentation to present to her father on what she knew about the app, what the privacy policies were, everything she would do if she had it. And she had to make that presentation and pitch her dad and before he could decide whether or not she was able to download the app. And I thought, wow, great parenting, number one. But number two, and I remember I said this to the dad, I'm like, that's an awful lot of work. And he's like, think about how much work it's going to be and how much time my daughter's going to put into that app. Probably an hour or two a day. Mm-hmm. So what I'm asking her to do is so little compared to what the app is going to ask from her. So I love that activity. And I don't know that, I would expect every kid to go to such extent, but I think it is important for our kids to really investigate what they're getting into before they simply download something else onto their device.
I took that idea. I'll confess, I didn't make them do the PowerPoint, but I did make them. My son had wanted Snapchat. And so I think we've been kind of later than most, my senses. But I had both he and my daughter ask those questions. And my son, an idea. So that forced me also to do some research to make sure that they were actually correct in what they were exploring. And there were a couple times when I thought, I don't think that's right. And so we had some conversations about, what does Snapchat own or what don't they own? And so things like that.
I mean, that's what I do with the students in the classroom is I have them read the privacy policies of those apps. And some of my students discovered a couple of years ago that Snapchat keeps those snaps. They don't actually disappear. And they were shocked. Like they were mad. So a lot of the kids just immediately deleted that from their phone because that's how adolescents are.
Right.
They're like, I'm mad. They're very black and white. So I thought that was, I don't know how long they stayed off, but I thought that was kind of funny.
Can you talk about the notion of the digital on-ramps as part of the kind of educational process?
Yeah. Well, because digital media is all around us, I think saying no digital media to a kid at any age is completely impossible today. I mean, we have to just come to that realization. And so what I offer for the young parents is the idea of digital on-ramps. Like instead of just here's the phone, good luck. Mm-hmm. There's things we can do at every step of the developmental age that's appropriate and do together. As an example, the American Academy of Pediatrics has said that no media at all for under 2 years of age and under. However, they say that screen chats or, you know, video chats, Skyping with loved ones is okay for that age set. That's a great way to introduce a very young child to digital media. You know, put them on your lap, screen chat with a parent who might be out of town, and they see you using digital media in a thoughtful, useful way. And then as they get older, on-ramp them in different ways. Maybe, you know, between 2 and 5, watch a little short educational video together and talk about it. And then as they get older, perhaps Google homework help together or look at tutorials about something they're doing in school. But the idea is on-ramp them slowly. Don't just throw them out there and good luck and binge watch whatever. You know what I mean? But do things that are developmentally appropriate. You do it together and you explain.
And this goes back to what you said earlier too, is, and I don't want this to sound like I'm shaking my finger because I put myself in this category too, but you have to parent, you have to actually spend time with your child and have these conversations and realize too, one of the things that the book did for me was think about what is my child, when they see me engage with my devices, what do they see? Right. Am I sometimes so involved in whatever it is that I'm not listening to them, or that I miss a question that they ask? And so it also forced me to think about my own uses and time on it as well.
Right. I mean, that's what I hear a lot from students. You know, what they see their parents doing is coming to their athletic events or their school performances, mm-hmm. looking at their phones. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's a little hurtful when you're a kid. And that also, that's what they think it means to be an adult, you know, that your phone or whoever's on your phone is more important than who's in real life. And I think that's very simple modeling that we can shift that will mean a lot to the next generation.
Can you also talk about the biological impact that screens have? That was a aha moment for me too, in the whole sense of the dopamine hits that we receive. And I would imagine regardless of the age, that is particularly potent for young people.
Exactly.
So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, you know, the device manufacturers in Silicon Valley, they're no dummies, right? The reason they make these devices is to make money. That's the business model. And in order to make money, they need us to use them more. And to use them more, they just have behavioral techniques that they've built into the devices. Every time we get a ding or a text message or something, we get a tiny hit of dopamine, which makes us feel good. And then when we open up to see whose text message send us a text message, we get another hit and we feel great. And that's a vicious cycle. So it's really hard for us to put the phone down or walk away from it when we know it feels good to see what's happening on there. And I mean, there's been studies I talk about in my book that compare it to, you know, the addiction of gambling or food or other addictions that people have. So, you know, I think sometimes as parents, we forget that because we're like, put down your phone. Why can't you just put down your phone? But for a kid, that's a very powerful impulse. Mm. In addition to that, what it's delivering is their friends. So, you know, what I like the saying, I didn't make it up, I heard someone say it, you know, what our kids aren't addicted to their phones, they're addicted to each other. Mm. So there's a lot of things happening developmentally, behaviorally, that it's really hard for kids not to be on their devices if they have their devices in their hands all the time.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little bit and talk about, again, about digital reputation. And I'll bring it into this whole podcast is about failure. And so I think as adults, we've all had experiences of, I'm sure, social media failures where we post something and we regret it. And sometimes we can go back and delete it, but other times it's too late. And so for children especially, can you talk a little bit about what happens when they experience a social media failure, when they post something they shouldn't have, and when they want to walk something back? So you talk a little bit about the 3 C's of posting before you post something, but then can you also talk about how do you help a child when they have posted something and it goes wrong for them?
Yeah. Well, you know what, that's a great question. And kids ask that all the time. And what I always tell kids is, you know, digital reputation, it's an entirety of everything. You know, if you have an unfortunate one bad post or someone tags you in something that you're not very happy about, you know, counterbalance it with good stuff. Post, you know, the essay contest you won or the time that you did something really cool after school or surf contest that you competed in. and balance it out so that when someone sees your digital reputation, they see the whole person, not just this one mistake that you made. So that's half of it. But I think the other half of it, as a culture, I think we have to be more forgiving. I think, you know, kids make mistakes. That's where they are. You know, we made mistakes when we were teenagers, and kids are making mistakes. And unfortunately, they put it online, or their friends put it online and tag them. And I don't think it's fair to judge a kid on one or two mistakes. I think that we have to look at the big picture. So I think both of those things have to happen at the same time.
Can you talk about the three C's of posting?
Right. Well, I actually got that from a friend of mine, Sue Sheff, who wrote a great book called Shame Nation. And she talks about the three C's a lot. So when you're posting, number one, conduct. Think about how you act online, same as when you act offline. Number two, content. Think about what you share online. And number three is caring. Remember, there's a person at the other side of the screen. So post with caring and empathy.
Hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, I didn't give you this question beforehand, but I'm curious about the future of technology. And are there things coming down the path that you may or may not be familiar with that you are at least a little concerned about? I think about things like virtual reality or anything else. Is there anything else out there that causes you some concern?
Yeah. You know, in the third level of cyber civics, it's our media literacy level. And at the very end, we have a unit on digital leadership that talks about future technologies. So it's something that I work with students with. And so we're looking a lot at artificial intelligence. Who's doing the moral thinking in the more artificial intelligence that's going to make these really big ethical decisions? Like, how does that happen? The other thing is, in our fake news unit, we talk a lot about deep fakes, because that's, you know what that is, right? Or your audience knows that that's when you can manipulate somebody's face and make it seem as though they're saying something that they never said, and they're very hard to detect. So talk about that in class, because you have to be a really smart media consumer today to be able to detect things that aren't true or real. So there's a lot of technologies coming that I think we have to prepare young people to be aware of.
Yeah, because as you note over and over in the book, technology is not going away. And it would take a Herculean effort to have your kids off of technology. And so I appreciate the metaphor of tool.
It's coming fast and furious. It's coming fast and furious. And I think the best we can do is really prepare our kids to be critical thinkers of any kind of media that comes their direction.
Mm. Well, I appreciate all your thoughts on this. And I was wondering, I always end these conversations by asking folks to share a story of failure for themselves. And so this doesn't have to be social media or technology focused, but anything from your life, personal or professional, or anything else that you realize that you probably went astray and wouldn't mind sharing today.
Well, you know, I didn't come to teaching as a teacher. I came as a parent who got into the classroom and started teaching these lessons that I had been trained for. And so I had a lot of classroom failure, and specifically teaching cyber civics. And I think every time I had a lesson that on paper looked so great to me, and then I do it in the classroom and it just fell flat with the students, it felt like a failure, but really it was a win, because it taught me to make better lessons and better activities that resonated with them. And so the failure in the classroom was really important. You know, it wasn't fun the day it happened, but I think the yield of it has been, I've been able to really perfect things that resonate with children.
Were you able to, when you experienced that failure in the classroom, how long did it take you before you were able to look back and say, actually, I can learn from this? Or I would imagine early on that for all of us, probably when we have that, we think, I should just quit teaching because I'm not any good at this. Were you able early on to say, well, you know what, this did not go well, but I know what I can learn from this?
You know, I think I turned it around pretty quickly just because I had great mentors.
Okay.
You know, I was surrounded with really great teachers and really great educational advisors that said, okay, that's when you get better. You know, is when you learn from your failures and you perfect what you're doing in the classroom and you go in and try again.
Yeah.
And so, had I been alone in the venture, I think I would have said, forget it. But I had a lot of encouragement and help along the way.
That's a really good reminder when we talk about resilience and perseverance. And I think sometimes in the American mindset, it's all about just keep at it no matter what. And that model can be very individualistic. And so it's helpful, I think, to think about, who can I draw from mentors, other people that I'm around that can help me through this.
Right. It's so important. You can't go it alone. All need help.
Yeah. Well, Diana, thank you so much for spending time with me. Her book is Raising Humans in a Digital World, and I highly recommend it myself. And remind me too, what is your own website, dianagraber.com, or what's the website that people can go to?
Well, I was going to say probably for the book, the best one is to go to dianagraber.com. And the reason for that is there's a discussion guide that accompanies the book that's free on the website. So they can go there and just look for discussion guide and download it. But I really like the discussion guide because it has guiding questions that if you gather in a book club or with a community of other parents, you can talk about the topics together. And that's super helpful.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you again for writing the book and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Diana for giving her time for this conversation. As you noted at the end there, you can learn more about her books or read her columns and go to her website, dianagraber.com. You can also follow her on Twitter, @DianaGraber. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.